Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Diana Wymar is a US-based embroidery artist and curator and founder of the Tiny Bricks Project, a crowdsourced collaborative art movement that is seeking to immortalize the utterances of Donald Trump and like-minded people so that they may be captured and challenged in a world where fake news is ever prevalent. The Tiny Pricks Project is magnificent. The contrast of words being stitched on vintage fabrics and just the sheer scale of the project, in which thousands of people have stitched phrases that resonate with them, things that they wish to challenge, points that they wish to draw to people's attention through the power of needlework. It's a fantastic project. I'm so in awe of it. This is the second part of our needle exchange, and Diana and I talk about her new book, Crafting a Better World, in which she learns lessons from several different people who have got craftivism projects across a range of media as well. The book is interesting in that it's not just Diana's perspective on what collaborative activism through craft can be. She has several touch points with many different artists, and I think that's a really magnanimous way of approaching the subject. We talk about craftivism. Obviously, this is the second part of the Needle Exchange. We find out the kind of music she likes and her other cultural touch points. We also discover that she lived in the back of beyond and didn't have electricity as she was growing up, which she casually drops in at one point. You go, I'm sorry, what? In fact, I think that's what I said, so you can look out for that. Do follow Diana's work on Instagram. You can find the Tiny Pricks Project there. You can find Diana's website. All the links are in the show notes. You'll be able to find out where to buy her book from. I really enjoyed the book. I think it's a great asset. And if you're into craftivism, it's another good book to have in your library. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please do let me know. Feel free to comment on the Mr. X Stitch Instagram. Let us know what you think there. You can always email hello@needle.exchange. I always say, sorry about this, I'm going off on one now. I always say that there's only one E, but obviously Needle Exchange has technically got like four E's in it, as opposed to five E's. So now I'm going to say there's only the four E's in Needle Exchange. That's even better, isn't it? Anyway. But thanks for being here. I hope you're enjoying the show. It's always a pleasure. I'll be back next week with a different conversation with a different needlework artist. But for now, enjoy the show. Can I read you a quote?
Yes.
Okay, bear with me. Inspiration comes to me in one of two ways, a slowly building wave or as a sudden prick. The former is an amalgamation of memory objects, emotions, experiences, outside influences, books I'm reading, places, photographs, events, time in nature and former selves. It gathers momentum until it has enough energy to peak. The latter comes as a flash almost out of nowhere. It is sharp and impulsive. I know exactly what to do and how to do it. I can see it before it exists. Either way, once inspiration calls, it must be answered. Discuss.
Discuss. Do you want the slow building answer or do you want the prick answer? Well, so we discussed already in the podcast that the prick, the kind of the Simone Biles quote. I didn't go looking for this quote. I guess I should say there's always a call and response. So I listened to Trump's interview in which he said, you know, these immigrants are coming and taking black jobs. And I was like, oh, I don't want to stitch his words. I don't want to stitch that. But the prick was, so that feeling was there. When I was scrolling and I saw this, just happened to pick up my phone before getting ready for my interview with you. I saw her post. It was immediate. I love my black job. It's just so brilliant that I could see it. It was just quickly getting it out. That's the tiny prick. The other slow building is an issue that I have not figured out how to address or how to talk about. So I've done a lot of pieces since October 7th about children. Mm-hmm. And I think about those pieces a lot. I think about what I'm saying. I think about how to get to the point to stitch, what to stitch. You know, it's been a very complicated place to be on social media. It's not about me, but it has been, I have felt that I've let people down who've expected certain things from me in terms of my politics and what I would stitch and what I would say and taking a stance and what I would report on. So the very slow building is, I want to say something. I want to stitch something. I'm looking for the right words. And, you know, I was just going to pull it up and find the James. I did a James Baldwin piece. And that really, for me, was such a slow build. So, yes, that piece didn't take me a long time to stitch. But I thought about stitching a piece. How to address the images of children suffering. How to say something that's just not going to add fuel to a fire, but is not also turning my back and walking away. And so this is the James Baldwin piece. The children are always ours, every single one of them, all over the globe. And I'm beginning to suspect that whoever is incapable of recognizing this may be incapable of morality. So that's not like a sudden prick. That's not that is a feeling. And I don't know, did I figure it out or was that the right quote? I think it is. I stand by that quote. And that's the slow building. And so that comes from, you know, a lot of different places that I have come from. And I have four children. So I think about children. They're adults now, young adults. But I think about that and care. And it's just a slow build. It just comes out of a different place.
Is it like notes of a chord where eventually the notes come together in the right configuration and you go, oh, there it is. Like, there's the note.
Yes. And it's funny you say notes because I know you talk about music and I was thinking about, you know, like there are just times when I'm stitching a piece and songs, I don't have necessarily a favorite album, but songs just come right into my head as I'm stitching, you know. And so when Harris said, like, say it to my face, all I could hear was Lady Gaga's poker face. Like, just kind of you know, hands over my ears. So in that case, the music, it does actually prompt music sometimes. And so I do post pieces with songs.
Because you studied creative writing, didn't you? So what's interesting, I guess, is, you know, what you're talking about there is the process of, is it seeking creative writing? Is it finding the right words to say, except your decision is to use the words of other people? Is that something you're able to, like pick up on through your own study?
It makes me so happy to quote writers and artists, because I remember during the Trump presidency, I had a friend whose book was coming out, and I asked him if he was going on tour. And he said, you know, I can't get coverage. Trump dominates. And then I flew back home to Victoria, BC, and I picked up the local paper there, and there was a piece on Trump. And I thought, right, there's only a certain amount of space. So if you have a book coming out, you're competing, you know, and everyone with Trump, you were competing with Trump for space. And so I thought, the minute I can start stitching words by writers and journalists and musicians and other people, I am going to, because if I am seeking some sort of relief, then surely other people are. And as a creative writing major, I have a love of writers. And so I've messaged so many of them and said, can I stitch a quote of yours? Sometimes I do without asking, but I, you know, short, and I include the attribution, but I just think anything to bring good words into this space. I mean, surely if I'm offering, you know, thousands of Trump quotes, I can offer something else to go with that to help, because I think that's where we are now, is this balance. You're addressing something. So if you're addressing it, remediation can't be only out of fear.
Yeah. As I said earlier, it feels like a lot of the statements that are made are because people are going, this doesn't resonate with me as a being who is loving and caring. And so there's almost like, what do they say? You know, the stories are like, oh, the sky used to always be dark. You know, I can't remember whether it's a sci-fi thing or something. And they're like, the darkness isn't winning because look how many tiny pricks of light there are or whatever. Tiny pricks. Okay. It probably is along those kind of lines, isn't it? It's just like that maybe there a tide will turn. You know, it's been interesting talking to some of my more politically aware friends over here, how nice it is to hear about the optimistic ideas that are coming out of the government and what a sense of relief there is to think that maybe things could get better. And you wonder whether that is, maybe there is a turning point, maybe one of the reasons where this desire to share the love more obviously is coming from is because there's a sense of that. I mean, the sense of relief between this point in time now and say 2 weeks ago must be kind of incredible, because I feel like 2 weeks ago some guy may or may not have nearly got shot in the ear or whatever, and it felt like, oh my god, it's over. And now it's just a whole nother kettle of fish. I mean, maybe, I don't know whether you feel that influences the tales you want to be pulling out and resonating with, whether there's a difference.
I felt when the assassination attempt occurred, I had a hard time with people making jokes about it. And I had a hard time seeing the image of Trump pumping his fists in the air with blood across his face. And again, not to go back to, you know, being a parent, but an assassination and, you know, jokes about like people, I know the assassin missing, you know, I don't want to see Trump assassinated. I don't want to see anybody shot, period. I don't want guns around. I don't want that language. And I just thought about, had he been assassinated, think of how that would feel to, you know, kids going back to school, you know, in, you know, doing active shooter drills in their schools. I mean, this is not, I felt, I wanted to see, you know, Biden and Trump appear on a stage together and say, you know what? We're not, this is not us. It doesn't matter who this very unwell person was. It's just not us. So yeah, I didn't know how to quite address that. But I was sitting with it for a little while. And then, of course, there was the debate, was things happened quickly. And then when Harris stepped in, it was an interesting moment to see how people reacted and to allow yourself to feel joy. And I did not know how happy I would feel to see Baldwin on the stage again, this national stage to see. And I thought, I don't want to model for my kids unhappiness with politics for, you know, another decade. I, you know, want to feel this moment. Isn't it exciting? And, you know, Mary Oliver said, joy is not meant to be a crumb. You know, allow yourself this moment. And then I realized, well, you know what? People immediately start, there's some joy. And then they start thinking, oh, you know, but she did this, but this, but this. And I thought, there's no perfect candidate out there. And I'd have people who would message me privately and say, I love your work. People always seem to, you know, qualify, I love your work. Someone says, I love your work. Here it comes. And I'm definitely there for it. I love feedback. As long as you're kind. I don't want to be told mean things, which I have been. But you know, I'm stuck on Harris. Like, I'm stuck with her record or this or that. And I just say to them, or her you know, policy relative to Gaza. And people say to me, I can't vote for her. I can't after what I've seen. And I say, there are two choices. I just see two choices. Mm. Let's just get, you know, let's just go with the better choice. I think the better choice. And then go from there. The work doesn't stop. Just like I thought my project was going to be over when Trump was out of office, forgetting that there was a world he created or was there, created for him. I don't know which. It's naive to think that we stop this work. And so the work now is to say, there's an election. It's very simple. You know, it's not a third party candidate. We don't have that here. There are two choices. And then what do you do after you have the better choice? Hopefully it goes smoothly. Hopefully it's not drawn out. Hopefully it's not violent. Can we be grateful for that? Because what the assassination attempt suggested is that this is a violent sort of, you know, this is a violent situation.
Mm. Yeah.
Which, so that's not a good feeling. So I'm, you know, I did a piece of something that is a Rebecca Solnit quote, which is, you know, voting is not a Valentine. It's a chess, you know, it's a chess move, you know, just vote and then do the work that you want to do or that you want to see happen.
Mm. I thought the minute that Beyonce went, oh yes, you can use my music, I was like, okay, we're on. This is a good move. I did want
to... Oh, we're on, yeah. That I mean, come on. That is on. And that has been fun because I've had to rely on, so I think a lot about the next generation, whether it's your own children or other people's children or young adults, but this is really about the future. And it so quickly got out of my hands that I would have to go to my kids and say, like, explain the coconut, explain this, you know, is Brat, explain this to me.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in my account were also like, I don't quite understand. And I was like, I know, but how exciting.
Yeah.
That I don't know. Cause as you were talking earlier about becoming an adult and realizing that you don't know things, I realized I didn't know things when my kids started to tell me that I didn't know things.
Yeah, definitely, isn't it? Yeah, there's a couple of podcasts I listen to that explain that one. So I can, I mean, my kids are 5 and 7, so they're not my point of reference. But as an aside, like, there's this issue that's come up about, like, trans people boxing, and we're definitely not going to get into that debate. But I've got a couple of people who I just ask their questions. I go, imagine I'm like a middle-aged old man who doesn't have a clue. What should I be thinking about this? What is the enlightened direction that I should be applying to this? And I'm very grateful for those perspectives because it moves so fast. I wanted to ask you as well about Instagram's been quite integral to the growth of the project and the success of the project. And yet there's a lot of opinions put forth within the comment section of many of your pieces. And I wondered how you felt about that, how you've evolved and presumably developed your own resilience in that respect.
So first of all, I could not do what I'm doing without social media. So just to be, you know, I think clear and somewhat transparent, social media has allowed me to do this work because I had been parenting and I live quite far away from the place where the things that are happening, you know, that I'm covering. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have a gallery. Social media gave me an opportunity. It levels the playing field in a lot of ways that I really appreciate. And I really appreciate being able to be contacted and have people contact me. A lot of the contributors to my book have come through Instagram relationships. And it's a way, it's not speed dating or something, but we like each other's work. And that's a really nice thing. I am very grateful for this opportunity. I also had a situation in which my Instagram account disappeared for over 24 hours. It was gone. And I had a moment of trying to figure out what that meant, what I was going to do about it. And when it first disappeared, I called my husband and I said, this is quite a while ago, but still, I said, call Instagram. And he's like, you don't call Instagram. 800 number to call. And it was one of the most important nights of my professional life when it disappeared. It was the opening of the show in 2019 at Lingua Franca. And The New Yorker was covering it and the Resistance Survival Chorus had sang. And I just reached 10,000 followers. And I went to check my phone after the opening and my account was gone. It was like I had been erased. And all the comments, all the people, I mean, at that point, the project was about 600 pieces. And I went to bed that night, eventually at 3 a.m. But before I went to bed, I thought, would I like to have the physical collection be, you know, burn or disappear, be gone, or this other digital collection? Which two things matter? And what I missed, I realized I could rebuild it and it was restored, but I would never be able to, I would have to recreate that community. And how would people find me again? And how would I find them? And so what I realized about social media is that it's an incredible community. And I'm very grateful for that. But I also feel some responsibility, not for my own safety, but for the safety of others. So if you comment on a post, what I find most challenging is, and somebody posts something, you know, offensive or difficult or attacks you, is it my responsibility to manage this? That's something I've struggled with because I want people to feel safe or at least to have an interesting, safe discussion. I don't want people to attack each other. So I can tell when they're trolls. I can tell when they're bots. You know, I can tell sort of generally what somebody's intention is, and I can tell when they start to attack comments after certain posts. I can tell. I won't use a hashtag NRA because I'll just attract people who don't, not really there for the embroidery, shall we say. Didn't come for the embroidery, you know, come for the embroidery and stay for the conversation. So I've learned to treat it a little bit like a community workspace, the way you would if you were giving a workshop. And then I also have had to learn to let go of it because I cannot spend my time managing all of it. And, you know, fair enough, people do expect you to keep your community safe. You know, they do expect you to maintain some integrity. There's the post. That's your work. And then everything kind of follows it. And you're a little bit responsible for it's, you know, what happens in the gallery. But this is a really big gallery and you have no bouncers and you don't, you know, you know, but I do feel some responsibility. And the other thing I learned about social media is I can block people. I'm not an elected, you know, official. I can block people. And believe it or not, it was hard for me to do that because I, you know, free speech. And that took me a little while to figure out. No, this is my account. Actually, even most Instagram is Meta's really, but this is my content, and I have some control over that. So a lot of it was figuring out what happened after I post. What does this community mean to me? What is the value of it? What is my what is my responsibility and what is not my responsibility?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I wonder whether if you had the resource, whether there's a correlation between the topics that people have stitched the most and the topics that people have commented on the images of the most. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if you could draw some parallels. It feels like that would be a naturally occurring phenomenon.
Exactly. And that's what was lost when the account disappeared briefly, because each of those comments has also its own kind of record. So when, you know, with my work, and I think a lot of artwork, it can really be a ripple. And this is just a stone that's dropped. And how that ripple moves over the surface has a lot to do with the surface and all these different conditions. So how do people respond? It's not what you would think. What I will say, though, is that people become much faster at trolling you and attacking issues. I have, over the last 6 years, just seen how the behavior has changed and how social media, Instagram, has become more professional, quote unquote professional. People are posting differently. It's shifted. And so I think there are more guardrails, but it's not a place for your 5 and 7 year olds. I mean, it's just not a place. They're not enough yet. We don't know enough about the formality. You know, a gallery has all these different rules and structures to it. And this gallery doesn't have, you know, all of those yet.
And yours is a gallery with what? Nearly 120,000 people looking at it, or, you know, potentially looking at it as well.
This potentially.
Is no small beans. Yeah, yeah. Then it turns out it's about 12,000 in the end.
Those numbers are not real. There are 120,000, however, 30,000 of them see each. I mean, we're not even going to talk about algorithms. So that's why it's so nice to, that was also why it was so interesting to work. I mean, the book came together very quickly, and working on the book, the book came out of Instagram, really, even though it's a physical book. So it was really nice to, it's really nice. I haven't seen the final book yet, but I can't wait. I love books. I love objects. So, but it was really interesting to take content and then from, you know, really, in a way, social media, because it's a small book. It's somewhere between a very long book and then a post, because it's you know, physically small, but it also, it has this hand, you know, it's sort of 1-to-1 ratio with your hand. You're holding it in your hands. It's a small book with messages from many different people. So
I'm going to formally introduce the book now, because that quote that I quoted earlier is a direct quote from the book. The book is called Crafting a Better World, Inspiration and DIY Project for Crafterists by Diana Weimar. Is it Weimar or Weimar? Or
it's Weimar.
Weimar. See, right down to edit that bit as well.
That's okay.
By Diana Weimar, creator of the Tiny Bricks Project. Get there in the end. So I was able to have a look at a review copy of the book, as it were, and I liked it, obviously. Now, what struck me about it, actually, is in the same way as the Tiny Picks Project is very much like your input, but very ably supported by the views and wisdom of other people, then so it comes with the book, because the book is essentially a collection of, is it 25 different people, their inputs, their ideas, and then you're holding their hands and kind of bringing that together.
I think I picked people who've held my hands. I think I felt like this was, when I was asked to do a book on craftivism, I just thought of community. I just thought of who's making something, whether it's a song or it's stained glass windows or it's a cookie or it's chocolate. Craftivism to me is just this making, this creating a connection. And I wanted to make it open and to present many different approaches, because I feel like we can find out how to do a lot of things technically on YouTube or on TikTok or wherever we go. We have so much information. We cleaned a grill yesterday. What did we do? We went on, you know, clean a grill. I mean, you know, it's a lot. And then I'm not even talking about ChatGPT. So I wanted something that said, talked about why you would seek certain people and seek certain work. What does, and it's that slow building wave. What does Roseanne Cash saying that she catches songs out of the air have to do with what I'm doing? Well, it turns out I've done a workshop with Roseanne Cash. She stitched a piece for the project. And I do think I catch quotes, and I love her music. And all of these people are just people that have been with me, or that I've admired, or both. And I wanted to make it accessible. I wanted it to give people a sense of the people who've inspired me. And then if they're interested, they can go looking for more information about these different artists, look at their projects, look at their work. I mean, if I added up all the books that these 25 contributors have written, or every movie they've been in, or every public project they've done, it's an enormous body of work. Mm. And so it's a curating. It's curating and bringing them together, and thinking about creative ways to look at issues and challenges, and to feel empowered to take a creative approach, to look at what other people are doing, and then take what works for you and sort of leave the rest behind. I don't have a specific kit for anyone to, you know, how to make a Tiny Pricks piece, but I can tell you why I make them and how I make them and why I love making them. Mm. And this book, I love this work. Each one of these contributors, I could spend weeks, you know, looking at their photography or with them or walking with them or, you know, reviewing their work. So I feel like their work has been a gift to me, and this is a little gift back. Mm. It just, here are some people who are doing some really interesting, amazing things. And I think you might enjoy reading about them.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I like about it, is the fact it's quite easy when you're picking a book to make it kind of almost like to have one perspective, or to make it like your take on the subject. And you could have quite easily written a book about what craftivism is to you, but instead you've gone, what is craftivism to 26 people, yourself included, in 26 different arenas as well. So in the same ways, you know, I quite like listening to music I've never heard before. This gives mm-hmm. you an opportunity to read about craft and activism that you've never thought of before. Like, I'm quite interested now in Furious Vulvas because they're made of chocolate. And I love the fact that there's a recipe in there for that. It may make 120 vulvas out of a single recipe. Mm-hmm. If it's enough.
Very great for back to school night.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of potential there whatsoever. But, you know, I really just like the different approaches that there are there. I also did want to shout out Danielle Kreiser, because I love the idea of, like, literally making your own gallery. Just make a little gallery. Just take a shoebox. Make a gallery. Put some little art in it and all that sort of thing, which I think is really empowering.
It is so empowering. It's a beautiful photo. Her work is amazing. Like you, she's had a podcast forever. Mm. I remember the time when I was in art school about 10 years ago, and I would listen to her podcast just thinking, someday, this amazing person who took a little idea, a feeling of being jealous of other people's artwork, and then, oh, you know, instead of being jealous of them, why don't I just embrace them and explore that feeling? So, you know, she's from BC also, so we know BC towns. And when I saw the photo in the book of her little library against the snow, and I think there's a fence in the background, I thought, I know that snow. Mm-hmm. I know that's the snow of my childhood in northern British Columbia. So there's a way in which, you know, I've written this book also to share, because this is craftivism to me. I mean, this is... it's including other people. I have been so lucky. People like you have taken, just looked at my work and said, yes, I'm interested. Mm-hmm. I'll help you. I have had so many people on Instagram and otherwise say, yeah, let's do this. And each one of these contributors, I mean, I went and spent a day with Giselle Fetterman and we made mosaic hearts. And yes, that's a craft. We're making mosaic hearts. But we're also telling the stories about the china that we're smashing. Mm. And she tells a story about a friend who brought her a cat that had been injured and gave her a little bowl for the cat, for the cat's food. And the cat ended up, because, you know, she had nursed the cat back to health. The cat got a bigger bowl. What did she do? She took that little bowl and she smashed it and she made a mosaic heart out of it with little shards from the bowl. You see, it turns back. Mm. And that's craftivism to me, because you have a choice with every single object you have. Where do you put it and who do you give it to and what do you do with it? Mm. And so all of these contributors are doing something with what they have, whether they have a platform or they bake or they make chocolates, you know, they take photos. It's just, it's so, to me, so beautiful and so, it's like my favorite yearbook. It's like my favorite album. You know? And I could have written three of these. There were people that have books coming out themselves that I'd asked, or the timing was bad. The turnaround was very quick because we wanted to get it out at this moment because we didn't know how people would be feeling.
Mm.
You know, how you don't know what's going to be happening.
Mm.
We had a pandemic.
Mm.
I still can't quite wrap my head around that. And when the pandemic hit, I thought the project was based on people getting together and doing workshops and being out and about. And I had a participant who was still doing pieces, and she said, and she was in her 70s, and she said, I'm waiting to go to the post office when it's not very crowded. And I thought, wait a minute, no, don't go to the post office. Don't mail in a piece. And so I changed the rules of the project to make it open to virtual submissions.
Mm.
So people send me images because I wanted to keep it going. And that's the thing about craft, I think, is it's adaptive. Each of these contributors has had different challenges or different things they're addressing, and you adapt.
Mm.
And so watch other people adapt to things. Then we can, I think we can do that ourselves.
Were there any noteworthy themes that you picked up from the conversations that you had, things that just almost everybody kind of said?
That's a really good question. And you just I just suddenly had a fantasy of having everyone together in a panel, but to have them talk to each other.
Hmm.
One day. Are there any universal themes of craftivism of the contributors? That's really interesting. I think one of the things I realized is that a lot of craftivism starts with a personal question. Finding yourself in a situation, Jamie Lee Curtis writes about finding herself in a room and sort of having a moment of wondering, what am I going to say here? What am I doing here? So I think one of the things I found was a common thread, mm-hmm. was this uncomfortable, known, unknown position that people found themselves in, and they knew some things, but they didn't know everything, and they needed to somehow merge these two feelings. How can I do this? Like, something's happening. What can I do? If you're, Danielle's example that you used of creating your own mini museum. Well, you can't go, you can't always go to a museum.
Mm.
You can have your own art gallery, and that's just a metaphor for creating something where you are,
mm.
and putting something literally out there and letting go of it. So I think it's this known, unknown feeling that a lot of these people have had, and then they work themselves into an answer.
Mm.
Tanya writes about during the pandemic, starting to propagate plants and wondering, starting with one plant and caring for something that's living and keeping it alive and gaining confidence with that process and getting another plant. And what is that relationship to that plant when you've been through and come out of a traumatic experience? So it's this moment of a little discomfort,
mm-hmm.
but that's the physically, excuse me, it's the doing something. Rochelle's is another example. She's suffering, going through postpartum depression, and she has a sudden idea, pull over the car, go into Joanne's, get some craft, materials, stitch something into a sweater. I mean, it's that impulse you had when you picked up your first cross stitch kit in the airport gift shop. But yeah, it's a moment of discomfort and then working into comfort.
Mm-hmm. And then, to be equally annoying, were there any particularly unusual discoveries? Did somebody give you an idea that had never occurred to you, but at the same time made perfect sense once they said it?
That's really interesting. Let me think for a minute. Selfishly, I wanted to spend a little bit of time with each of these people. So I don't, and I could spend a lot of time with them. One of the interviews that I started with Suleika Shuad, we had collaborated together in a series of posts when she was working toward clemency for Quentin Jones, who was on death row. And a lot of people become active and just sort of a campaign, a letter writing campaign, reaching out to the governor, you know, campaigning to grant clemency so that he could live out the rest of his life in prison, but not go to death row. And it's always been heavy for me that he was executed, you know, and so when I contacted her, I somehow felt I wanted to write about that story, about working together and stitching these pieces and working on that. And what she said to me was that she didn't have the same feeling of heaviness that I had, that we had somehow failed. And I was sort of talking about, like, I think I was thinking about when activism doesn't work, what do we do?
Yeah.
What do we do with ourselves? You know, I mean, you have to ride this wave of hope, and then does the wave have to crash and hit a wall and you're kind of knocked out for a little bit. But she talked about in her piece how much love he felt, how much love Quentin Jones felt getting letters from people. And really talked about that love in the moment and the way in which he died. And I just thought of him dying by execution, death row, and she thought of him dying loved and feeling loved. And so it reminded me to not to construct such tight conclusions.
Yeah.
Not to tell a story that has this success, failure. Oh, we didn't do that. That didn't work out. And so I'm really grateful to Suleika for sort of sharing how she experienced that work. And that's a gift. And I think that's a good reminder.
Yeah.
Because, you know, reading this book, you know, craftivism does often have a point to it, something you're trying to achieve. And it's a long process, and the outcome may not be what you expect or hope for, but in the process, you may have gained something entirely different.
Yeah, I think that's probably a really important thing to take, isn't it? Because as you say, it's quite easy to go, well, I'm putting together a piece, you know, a project with this goal in mind, and you focus so long on the goal that you don't see the build up towards it, do you? You don't recognize that for each of those people who've done those letters, they've written their personal connection to somebody, haven't they? So there's however many hours of love and empathy that have gone into that. And that's quite a profound kind of experience on the whole, isn't it? Yeah, it's interesting how you measure it. I think that's a really interesting take on things. I was always felt like that, even when I did the Christmas tree, or indeed when we did the Stitch for Syria project and we went over to Lebanon and we had these two wall hangings and they were just brightly coloured and you stuck them up on the wall. And it's just like, if you're able to, you can stop, as you did, as you said right at the start, you can stop and look at everything and suddenly tap into the time and energy put into it. And I can remember when they did the Christmas tree project and we had something like, we have like 600 baubles from around the world that people had stitched or something like that. And I got really emotional just talking about it, because I was just like, all I've said to people is come and stitch a cross stitch bauble. It's going to go on a tree so that people can enjoy Christmas and see all these things. And we had so many that they ended up being put all over the building and all kinds of things. But it was just like, you give people the opportunity to take part in their craft and you say to them, this is the good intention that comes behind it. And then people respond to that. And that's like really moving, isn't it? Because there's so many people who have just been feeling a similar feeling and putting their time in, and you can sit and look at this and you can just, like with the wall hangings, just go, here's just a colorful outpouring of love that strangers around the world have chosen to do so that we can present it to these ladies in this kind of like sewing project in the middle of Beirut or whatever. It's just like, yeah, I think, It's really interesting to not lose sight of that. I think you can lose sight of it, can't you? Even just on a day to day.
And the structure of these prescriptive projects don't always allow for the unknown, unlimited capacity of what you're offering. So, you know, you had a number, you had a space, you had to pick a certain idea about your project to framework. There's no reason you couldn't have had 6,000 baubles. That's what I realized with Tiny Pricks, because the numbers got so big that you know, someone said I had a goal of 2,020 pieces by 2020. Mm. And then we're like, why not more? Why not 20,000? Like, no, really, we don't think this way. We think this way with, you know, a Taylor Swift concert, you know, unlimited. But who wouldn't want to do that? You know, your project. I mean, and it is, they do come together. These pieces do come together. Multiples do matter in these cases. Because what they do is you can see this, the mass of humanity as opposed to an individual piece. And when you can do that, you're holding on to both the individual and the collective, which is just a beautiful, maybe that's what it's like being at a Taylor Swift concert. I don't know. I have yet to have that experience, but I imagine that it's that thing, the individual and then just everything, the eternity, you know, the great unknown.
Mm. So do you think, has the end goal changed? Like you say, you've got at this point, there's like 95 days till the election. Do you get a sense of the end of the tunnel, or is it going to evolve into something perpetual? Or are you going to go, you know, at a certain point, you know, 12 months after the election, I'm going to go, right, I can't do these anymore. This is a time capsule now.
Oh, yeah, the time capsule. That's the funny thing I realized is, it's hard to set a date because I switch from dates to events and they'll continue to be events. Mm. So at some point, yes. I mean, when do I sort of turn off the lights and say, you know, my work here is done? Mm. I think when something else comes along that draws me in a different direction. Mm. I loved working on the book. I would love to do another book. I would love to do a book of Tiny Perks Project. I mean, they're specifically the pieces. The pieces are amazing. Mm. I would love to exhibit all 500 and whatever they will end up being in one place. Mm. You know, could that be possible? So I think something, you know, bigger has to come along and pull me away from this thing that I already, you know, love. Mm. But I will say, and I don't know if artists are, and craftivists are always good at this, but I am going to try to take some time off. It's so easy not to, and clever me, I picked a medium that I could take anywhere, but the problem is I can take it anywhere.
Yeah.
And I don't need a kiln. I don't need a loom. It's just a little Ziploc bag. And I can do it everywhere. So I think I might take some time off at some point after this election and after the book is solidly launched and people have had a chance to read it and get to know it. But I don't know what's going to happen.
Mm.
And I do feel like at some point I would like to find a way to really address the climate crisis. And I haven't, that one doesn't have words exactly to it. And because I work with text and language,
mm.
It's been hard to get those words.
Sounds like you've somewhere at the back of your head, you've pressed a finger on a keyboard. You've gone, doom. But yeah, now you need the other fingers, don't you? You got like the slow build up of places. How does it go? Emotions, experiences, outside influences, well, that sort of thing. So,
well, okay. I do.
I'm going to go on to the really difficult questions. Now we've covered all the really easy stuff, like, you know, creative journey as a curator and all those sorts of things. The big questions now. Do you have a favorite album then? Possibly not.
When I grew up in the wilderness, we didn't have electricity or indoor plumbing, but my parents had a little tape recorder.
Can I just interrupt for 1 second? Sorry, is that going to be the interesting fact that not a lot of people know about you? Because you can't just casually go,
I think everybody knows,
I grew up in the wilderness and we didn't have electricity or running water.
I think everybody knows that about me. I think I have wilderness child written all over me, but that could be the interesting fact. My parents had these cassette tapes, and I can just remember every detail of them because when you only had three cassette tapes forever, 7 years? It was Tony Orlando and Dawn,
right,
with Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree. And I mean, that song, I spent much of my early childhood trying to imagine what that song meant, and just that moment when he finds the yellow ribbon around the old oak tree, and I just could relive it in my imagination over and over again. The other cassette tape was Judy Collins' Colors of the Day, and the third one was the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. So I don't know if those are my favorites, but when I hear them, it is a complete body experience. And right now, I have not actually re-listened to those three, not by cassette, but albums, because my father passed away almost 2 years ago, and I can't quite. So it is so powerful. So I don't know if they're my favorites, but I think they hold the most memories for me, and that's really for me what music is about. It's so much fun to draw upon songs of my, I mean, all the music I use in the project is music I used to listen to. So you have the Barbie movie, you have Pretty in Pink, you can pull back those songs that you listen to in different movies and things like that. But those three are very powerful. And then right now I'm not, maybe on my vacation.
Probably needs some Taylor Swift by the sounds of it. Do you listen to music while you're working? I feel like your work is so instantaneous that it might be, you could have music on, you could not have music on. It would largely be irrelevant because you're just banging that phrase out and it's just coming out of you.
So I don't listen to a lot of music when I work. I collaborate with Molly Jong Fast a lot. So I listen to her podcast. I listen to The Daily. I'm catching up on the news. So unfortunately it's mostly news podcasts, Pod Save America. And in part because if I'm going to post about the news, I'm trying to benefit from people who have already talked about this specific issue or topic or quote and can give me some information about it. And then I also just sit in silence.
Because you're a wilderness child, apparently, and that's all there was.
Because, you want to conserve the electricity just in case, you want to remember how to live without electricity.
Just listening out for the sound of a beaver going at a tree in the distance.
Sometimes there's music all the time. I mean, I don't know, family members get in the car, what immediately put on music, immediately. And sometimes I just want to listen to nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Get a space for your own thoughts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and to be able to do that and then go back to something, but mostly news podcasts.
What do you have a favorite book, or what was the last good book you read?
The last amazing book I read is Claire Massoud's This Strange Eventful History. And she uses family letters and photographs, and she tells a story of three generations of her family. I think it's seven different countries and over decades. And the way she's written it, I don't want to say too much about it, but the way this strange eventful history is written is that you are in the middle of the book and the structure is not mysterious in so much as it doesn't explain itself to you immediately. And so you have to surrender, as you should, if you're going to be taken to a book like this, which is a story of a family and their disappointments, their successes, their connection, their disconnection, and what it means to, I think, be a family that lives in different places, that because each place is a culture, is a politics, is a way of living. And as somebody whose parents left the U.S. when I was a year old to move to Canada, I grew up in Canada, but I was American and they were American. So I was hearing about all of these American traditions in another country. And so this idea of, can we go home? Where is home? How do we build a home? You have to surrender, I think. And so Claire's book is a really amazing reminder of fiction as a trip, as a journey, as a way of letting go of where you think you are and allowing yourself to go into a book. And I know, and I think it's different to read it than to listen to books. I know a lot of people listen to books now, but I think physically holding the book and even a voice gives you some feeling of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see the words are not, they're just words, flat words. They're not stitch words like my words where I can express something.
Mm-hmm.
There's a font, there's a page, there's the size of the book, but still you meet each other in a different place.
Mm.
So I can't recommend The Strange Eventful History more strongly.
I've got a, shall we call it a wifeful birthday on the horizon. And that sounds very much like the right kind of book that she'd enjoy reading. Because when she gets a good book, it's super annoying because she'll just come home from work and go and sit out in the garden for like 45 minutes reading. And I'm like, oh, mate, doing it for the kids then. You know, but like when she's in it, it's just so nice to see.
This is a book, your bathwater will get cold.
Excellent, excellent.
And I will say that it's a really, it's a good reminder of what it means to have different generations, to be connected to different generations. We connect in all these other communities, but how do we remember to connect to our parents, our grandparents, our children? And what's that sort of vertical thread that goes through the generations? So it's not instructive. She's not meaning to be instructive, but it is.
Mm.
You know, what do people in your family remember about you? How you spoke to them, how you interacted to them, what gift you gave them, how you made them feel about who they were, what you said to each other. So it's a beautiful book.
Yeah, I like it. I like the sound of that. Television/film. I seem to have lost the ability to structure my sentences now, so I'm just going to use broad nouns. Television/film. Do you have a favorite film?
Well, I think my favorite film of all time is The Sound of Music. And again, because my father's passed and I'm processing all, you know, a lot of my experiences with him, when we eventually left the wilderness, I could see movies. I remember my father saying, we're going to go see this movie called The Sound of Music. And given what I knew at that point of my father, I was very sure that I was going to go see a movie about musical instruments.
Okay, right.
And I was pretty bummed, to say the least. I was not interested. I was there for the popcorn and that was it. And then, of course, we went to see The Sound of Music. And I was just like, wow. I mean, Technicolor. Mm. So now when I think about the movie, I still think about them, you know, making clothing out of the drapes and hiking through mountains and, you know, the different things. So I think that movie, just because of that memory, you know, with my father, and that expectation and just the pure joy of seeing something that you did not expect to see.
Mm.
My mind was blown. And there have been movies since. I think Parasite was pretty good.
Oh, my mind is
definitely blown. Anatomy of the Fall. I mean, any movie that really, I don't want to see trailers. I don't want to read reviews. Mm. Just surprise me.
Mm. I've not watched Anatomy of the Fall yet because it's subtitled and therefore is cross-stitch incompatible.
Yes, I do know that. And I have, once my family members told me that we could not have the lights on so I could see and stitch. So I had to wear a headlamp.
Okay.
I think it was actually Apocalypse Now, because that's really important to see sort of in the dark.
Mm.
I had my headlamp like this stitching. Yeah, you know, Anatomy of Fall is not a great date movie. but it's really good.
Mm.
So
did you like the Barbie movie?
I'm not sure if you're bringing that up because you're giving me a freebie, but my story is that in 1994, my best friend from high school and I drove across the country in the US shooting a movie with Barbie dolls on Super 8 film. I'm not kidding. We had over 200 Barbie dolls. We had Elvis, Donnie Marie, Mr. T, Dolly Parton, and then Barbie, of course, and a lot of Kens, and Cher. We had Sonny and Cher, both dolls. And my friend had written a script about the life of Barbie. And in her movie, Barbie grew up in a small town, moved to LA, became a rock star, got very lost, as one does, and was on a spiritual journey to find herself again. So this is This is like 30 years ago. We shot it in Super 8.
That's amazing.
Drove across the country. She cut it. She showed it at a few festivals. That was it. So when the Barbie movie came out, I was like, oh my goodness. Oh my God. I couldn't believe it. What did I think about it? Yeah, great. Mm. I think it's great when we can, you know, I think communal experiences are great. It used to be that we would all see the same movies every summer and we would talk about them. So I think the fact that so many people saw it is great. I like Greta Gerwig. I think, you know, let's have the conversation. Let's see it. Let's enjoy it. Yeah,
it was kind of high stakes, wasn't it? It could have been dreadful, but she really pulled it off. I did. Me and Mary went to see it. Mary fell asleep about 5 minutes towards the end. You know, like the misty bit where it's all like the whole point of it is kind of revealed and all of that. And Mary missed that because she'd fallen asleep by that point. So I was so glad we did that. But
well, and also I think there was this story about Greta Gerwig using up all the paint of that color. So just on a creative perspective.
Yeah. In the UK as well, because it was filmed over here. You couldn't get that pink at all.
Materials.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and dressing up to go to a movie. I think these things are good. They're creative. I think.
I was, to be honest, I was one of the only like non-Barbie pink people at the cinema at that time. But I think that was fair because I think I would have looked a touch. Like it would have been a bit contrived if I'd have done it. Let's not say I don't embrace the spirit of it.
I wonder if you would have felt differently seeing it if you had been dressed in pink.
It's true. Maybe I'll do it at home. Just see if it resonates any differently with me. Right, one more. Is there an interesting fact, we've already had several, that not a lot of people know about you? I mean, you've already given me, we made our own Barbie movie and drove across the States and had 200 Barbies. That's a fact in and of itself. And then there's the wilderness era. I mean.
The wilderness era. That is a really good question. I think that I'm actually an introvert. And I think that that, people think if you're on social media, you're an extrovert. So if you're talking about like, what do people know about me relative to this project and this work, I think it's that I'm relatively quiet and introverted, and that this platform and this work has given me a chance to be less so.
Mm. Was there a tipping point where you were like, oh God, oh my goodness. Yeah.
I remember, during the pandemic, I had, you know, as we all were, I hadn't gone to see my GP and I hadn't done a follow-up breast exam. And I was in the shower and I found something that was kind of alarming. So I was able to go in and see my GP. And she said, I'm going to schedule a mammogram and ultrasound. I was like, oh, this does not sound good. Mm. And of course, to sort of intellectualize the situation, I thought, oh, this is interesting. The things that we don't schedule in the middle of a pandemic, of course, and what happens to this kind of care and maintenance that we need. So I was able to get an appointment, but quite a bit of time later, enough time to worry and think and constantly look for that spot, as one does. And I thought, oh, if I'm doing this, you know, this is being more extroverted. If I'm doing this, then surely other people are also not getting mammograms. So maybe I should say something because I just did this thing. And I discussed it with my daughters and I decided to post and say, this is tomorrow. I have this appointment and this is a reminder to continue to take care of yourself and check things out in middle of this in middle of the pandemic. And at that point, there was sort of pressure on Instagram to have more engagement. And my daughters were talking to me about engagement and making reels and things like that. And I was like, but this lump. And so once I did share this thing, and the response was, I still feel kind of emotional talking about it, was really overwhelming and generous and caring. And I said to my daughters, like, I can't answer all these messages the way I would like to. And they're like, Mom, this is engagement. It's called engaging because you engage. And I was like, oh, that's true. And it was a very touching moment because people offered to help me. You know, they offered to, someone said to me, I don't sleep very well right now. If you need to call someone in the middle of the night, you can call me.
Hmm.
So I came out, you know, and there were so many other women who were going through the same experience, like people who literally had appointments the same day I did. And then, of course, I felt after my appointment, after I got the results, which thankfully were benign, I should share the results because people were concerned about me. And that was when I really realized this is, like, figure out how introverted, extroverted you are, because I didn't want to draw attention to my situation exactly, unless it helped others sort of not be as sort of, you know, neglect their care the way I had. So that was where I sort of felt like I can't respond in the way I would like to, because this is so big, and I would want to respond to every comment and every offer and every expression of care.
Do you find that there's a coping strategy is the wrong word, right? But I take solace in the fact that I'm both Jamie Chalmers and Mr. Xditch, and in many ways they're very different people. And I think you probably have a similar option there, don't you? There's Diana, the person, and then there's Tiny Picks Project, and you as a curator of that. But there is a gap. And so that gap allows for a bit of, like, security, I think.
I think mostly there's Tiny Pricks. I was once on a Zoom call, and I wasn't allowed out of the green room. And I was getting kind of nervous to join the Zoom call. It was quite a few people. And someone finally said, oh, after they let me in, they later apologized. They said, oh, I didn't know your name.
Nice.
I saw you in the green room and I didn't let you in. I feel very lucky that both exists. Yes, there is a difference, but really, if you know me, that Tiny Pricks is sort of, that's what was so enjoyable about the book, is that's just who I am. So it is who I am. It's not everything, but it's a lot. And so, yeah, I feel they're very connected. I just they work in different places and have different jobs.
The Tiny Pricks would be your street fighting name if push came to shove.
It does confuse people. Once I had a show in San Francisco near the, I don't know if it's called the porn district, but wherever there are the sort of the adult clubs, and a couple came in. You have a show called Tiny Pricks Project, and they came in expecting something different. And I was like, no, it's about embroidery. So yeah, it's an interesting title, but it's stuck. And I always think of it as sort of to prick your conscience. That was sort of, and then the stitching, and I'm not as interested in that reference to anatomy, but, you know, there are a lot of different meanings.
I think it works perfectly.
Yeah.
And long may it continue to work perfectly as well, quite frankly.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, Diana, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's been a blast. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.